All right, good afternoon. It is February 4th, Thursday, 3 o'clock, and we're doing the afternoon Chem 12 lab. All right, so what we talked about this morning in this morning's lab was I did some quick calculations with people, just looking at the types of calculations that we do with this lab. We talked a little bit about running reactions and the scale of reactions that we typically run. We talked about how to calculate the limiting reagent. We talked about the differences between characterization of a product versus trying to stress purity, which most students want to stress whether the product is pure or not, which is not exactly what I want you to stress. I really want you to stress whether or not it is the actual product that you say it is, but not necessarily how pure it is. And then we looked at the spectroscopy in more detail, and then we talked a lot about formal reports. So I was going to kind of go through and just do the same sort of thing. And starting off with looking at our reaction and what we did with that reaction. So one of the things that you're going to be asked to do in the course of working up the report is to figure out what the overall percent yield of the reaction is.
Are you supposed to be sharing your screen?
Yeah, you know, it's supposed to just work. You're just supposed to write and it's supposed to share. It's supposed to do its thing. I shouldn't have to tell it that I need it to do this all the time. And I had a good span, I don't know, it was most of last semester, where I was doing Zoom in a different way. I would log in with my iPad and turn the sound off, and I would log in with my computer, and then I would screen share from the iPad, which just involved one click, and it was super easy. And now it's a big whole thing of like 5 different buttons that need to be pushed in order to share and get it going in the right direction. Okay, can you guys see now? You see the screen? We're good, okay. All right, so the percent yield of the reaction. In calculating the percent yield, it's a limiting reagent reaction. Or a limiting reagent calculation that needs to be done. And the reaction that we're doing, bromobenzene reacting with magnesium to produce phenylmagnesium bromide, and then that reacting with benzophenone and then acid to make the triphenylmethanol. And so we have three different things that we need to track in order to figure out which one is limiting. We need to track the bromobenzene. We need to track the magnesium metal. And we need to track the benzophenone. That any one of those three things could be limiting in the chemical reaction. And just working from each one of these, and I'm not going to go from my numbers that I used in the lab. I'm going to go from the instructions numbers. When you do the calculation, I want you to go back and do the calculation from the numbers that were used in the actual lab so that you can figure out what is limiting. Let's look at what was intended to be limiting based on, this is out of Pavia's lab manual. So what Pavia had wanted us to do is to use 0.70 milliliters. And this material had a density that was 1.5 grams per milliliter. And we were supposed to use approximately 1.05 grams of that material. Of the magnesium was supposed to be 0.15 grams of magnesium. And so just from these two here, we can calculate, and what I tend to do is I tend to go from the mass in grams to the moles. And then I like to go out to millimoles, a millimole being 1/1000th of a mole. Usually we don't talk about millimoles. Moles have always just been sort of the thing that we discuss, but within organic chemistry, we typically do things in the laboratory. We oftentimes work in sort of a 1 to 5 millimole range for lab experiments. Anything bigger than 5 millimoles starts to get really big and requires some pretty big glassware when you start to get into the 10 or 20 millimole range. And there's a lot of heat that gets generated and those reactions are hard to manage. So for reactions that we do, almost all of our reactions will fall in this 1 to 5 millimole range, which is why I like to work in millimoles as opposed to moles, because it's an easier number to manage rather than 0.005 moles. When you start looking at all those decimal places, it's hard to keep track. And this is just easier for sig figs, easier to keep track and just more manageable to work on a millimole level. Okay. So if we look at bromobenzene and let's list it out. Let's see how many millimoles this was intended to be. So this was 1.05 grams of bromobenzene. We'll multiply that. We need its molar mass. Its molar mass, I believe, is 157. And then to convert it into millimoles for every one mole, it's 1,000 millimoles. So we'll calculate it out that way. So 1.05 divided by 157.0 times 1,000, that's 6.69, or we can call it 6.7 millimoles. If I were following sig figs rules and I was going to go all the way back to like chem 3, we've got 3 there, we've got 4 there, this one's exact. I should be at 3 sig figs, so that should give me 6.69. I guess it's good to keep track and keep some of those old skills alive. So at 6.69 millimoles, let's see how many millimoles of magnesium we had. So magnesium, we were supposed to use 0.15 grams. And magnesium weighs 24.31. And for every one mole, it's 1,000 millimoles. And the reason I'm doing it out this way is just because I know it's been a while since you guys have done it this way. And those Chem 1A and Chem 1B skills might be a little rusty. So we're just kind of warming them back up. It's like you're going in to do a exercise class and starting out with some stretching to get started. So this reaction is running on a 6 millimole scale. So when I look at it and I said, yeah, we usually run 1 to 5, this is on the high end of that. We're running a 6 millimole scale for this chemical reaction. And the last one that we want to be able to calculate is the benzophenone. And I just want to remind you guys that you should be able to knock out a molar mass really quick. I get people that want to just Google it and look up a molar mass. But for organic molecules, you guys should be able to do this really easily. So practice doing it a little bit. You know, take a look at it, six-membered ring, 6, 12, 13. This is a C13. There would be 6 hydrogens if this were just a benzene ring. That takes up one position, so there's 5 others. 5, 10, no other hydrogens. And there's 1 oxygen. So to figure out the molar mass of that, it's 13 times 12.0114, that's for the carbon, plus 10 times 1.00794, that's for the hydrogen, plus 15.9994 for the oxygen. It's 172. Let's just call it 0.1 grams per mole.
I think your 10 turned into a 0 for the hydrogen.
It did. I was thinking that number wasn't sounding right. Thank you. I go back in and do second function entry. Sometimes I can bring back the entry. That's all right. We'll just put it back in. 13 times 12.0114 plus 10 times 1.00794 plus 15. That's better, 182. Okay, so here we were supposed to obtain 1.09 grams. And so it's 182.2 grams benzophenone. Let's just call it benzo for every 1 mole. And then for every 1 mole, it's 1,000 millimoles. So out of these, what was intended, it was intended that this one be limiting. That was supposed to be our limiting reagent. So now, was that our limiting reagent? I don't know, because we would have to go back in and we would have to see the actual masses that we use for bromobenzene, magnesium, and benzophenone, go through that and figure out what is limiting. How do I calculate my percent yield then? There's 2 ways to calculate your percent yield. You can take the mass actual divided by the mass theoretical, And this is of the trichinal methanol. Uh-oh, gardeners are here. It's Thursday. It's not good. My dogs hate the gardeners. Well, particularly Finley, particularly the leaf blower and the lawnmower just kills him. He's going to be a wreck after this. And this is for the trichinal methanol. The theoretical amount is the amount that we would calculate from the stoichiometry. And then you simply just multiply this by 100. And that gives you your percent yield. Or what I would do, or what I find helpful, is the millimoles, the actual millimoles of trichinal methanol. Divided by the theoretical millimoles of the limiting reagent. And multiplied by 100. You should come out with the same number. And the reason is that this reaction stoichiometry is 1:1:1. It is, going back to the reaction picture, it is one equivalent of bromobenzene to one equivalent of magnesium to one equivalent of benzophenone in order to make trichinal methanol. So there's no coefficients on any of these reagents that changes our calculation or makes our calculation difficult. So it's a straight 1:1:1 ratio. And so the millimoles can all be directly compared and you can calculate your percent yield either by going through the mass and finding the mass of the trichinal methanol and the mass of trichinal methanol that would be from the limiting reagent, or you could just use the millimoles of trichinal methanol and the millimoles of the limiting reagent and divide those into each other and multiply by 100, and that will give you your percent yield. I'll tell you that the percent yield on our reaction was somewhere approximately 65%, 65, 66%. I think it was 67% before I let the material dry, and then after I went back and weighed it the second day, I lost 1/10 of a gram over the mass of the material, which knocked down the percent yield just a little bit. So that's not too bad. So you're looking for a number that's around 65% when you go through and do it. Okay, that's the percent yield component. And let's talk for a minute about how this reaction was run. We ran this reaction in a 25 mil round bottle. It was approximately 6 millimole reaction. We had about 0.7 milliliters of bromobenzene. We had 4 milliliters of diethyl ether to make that solution, another 2 milliliters for the rinse. We had about 1 milliliter worth of volume of benzophenone, and another 2 milliliters of diethyl ether that went into that. And then we had another 1 milliliter of diethyl ether that was rinse. And we had 6 milliliters of 6 molar HCl. So our total volume that went into the round bottom before we took it out to put it into the separatory funnel, we were at, what is this? 10, 14, 15, 16, almost 17. We were approximately 17 milliliters in a 25 mil round bottom. That takes us in a 25 mil round bottom, that takes us about as high as I would go. Usually the golden rule, so 17 mils is going to be somewhere about that volume. And the rule that I like to do, if it's 25, so it would be 12, is that not much beyond half. We usually like to stay within half on a round bottom, and that our total volume will not exceed half. The reason is that if you generate heat or things expand, that if you don't have enough headroom for the gases to expand into, it can create dramatic pressure buildups and the apparatus can fail if you're filling it above the halfway mark. Plus, it becomes very difficult to remove the contents of the flask by pouring or rotovapping or doing other things when the flask exceeds half full. So we try to limit it so that we don't ever fill it more than halfway when we take all of the materials that are going to end up in there all the way through the workup. Right, so that we have here two different parts. We have the part that is the reaction, and then we have the part that is the workup. And you need to consider both the reaction and the workup in your total volume and everything that's going to go into that round bottom to decide on the right size round bottom before you start the reaction. Pavia has done all this work for you. But I think it's important that if you're going to like design your own reaction, that you figure out, how do I do that? And it starts just by taking account of everything that's going to go in it and adding it all up. So that's how we know that we should be in a 25 mil round bottom. All right, let's start talking about the formal report a little bit. And there's a couple of areas of the formal report that I want to touch on, besides just doing the whole thing. There's a lot of anxiety over formal reports. Formal reports probably produce more anxiety than anything else within chemistry. It's a big report. It's a big thing. And you guys haven't had any experience because you didn't do any in Zaruba's class. I don't know if you did any in Albie's class. And so you don't have a whole lot of experience doing formal reports. And so that creates even more anxiety. You've got a couple of resources that I've put out for you. Both in Canvas and on chemed.study. They're a little bit more concise on Canvas because I put them all in the same place. You have a formal report rubric. You have a formal report outline or guidelines. Within the formal report guidelines, there are examples of both methods and material section. And the method section is the actual Grignard experiment. So the method that I chose to use as my example method when I wrote those guidelines was I actually wrote the Grignard method. And so you could look at that to see exactly how you should be structuring your method. And we'll go and we'll take a look at that. And then there is an example formal report. This is a report from a former student, Nicole, and this was on the aspirin lab. And so you've got those three things that are really core important things to look at, to model after. And let's go take a look at those real quick. So if I jump over into Canvas and I go down into the modules. So I'm looking at the module, I'll go back here. Go all the way back into modules. And from modules, you scroll down until you get to the Grignard reaction. In the Grignard reaction, under the formal report, the last tab, there is those list of components there to help you. And so let's start at the bottom, the formal example. This is the example that I took that was from Nicole Balonzi. And Nicole did her report. So it was just a good one that I had read that was on aspirin, and I chose it to keep it around and hold on to it as an example to show students. And she has her abstract there, and the abstract tells what was done and what was found. She has her introduction. The introduction goes over why this lab is important. For aspirin, it's because it was the first pharmaceutical that was a manufactured pharmaceutical that was not just a natural product, it was something that was synthesized. And so that modification was the important focus component, not how it works biologically or why it works biologically, but the actual synthesis of that molecule was what was the important component within this experiment. So she goes through that very quickly. And then she has a last paragraph, which is what is called a non-technical overview. And the non-technical overview is a segue between sort of the history of what was done and this paper and what this paper is going to be on. Then she gets into her methods and materials, and she chose to, instead of writing out the method entirely, she chose to cite Pavia and just said that the procedure in Pavia was followed with only the following modifications. And then she has a reference there, which gives a reference for Pavia. And she says the modification was a sand bath was used to control heat instead of a hot water bath. And then she has her list of reagents, everything that was used during the experiment, and then all the equipment that was used to do the experiment. And this part, the equipment, I keep hitting a button there, I'm sorry. this equipment I have to get you yet. I have to give you a list of all the equipment because you can't go into lab and get it for yourself. So I'll print out a list for that and I will put a link to it in Canvas as well as one of the resources that gives you all the equipment was used. But that equipment that was used, we list it out with its model number, the software, the year the software that was produced, the type of press that we use for the FTIR, the melting point devices, and the thermocouple thermometers that we use with them. We list everything. She then goes through her results, which are shown in table format and in paragraph. And then she goes into her discussion. And classically, we start the discussion with a mechanism. Yours is going to be a little bit different than that because the mechanism is short and different. So we'll talk about that in a second. But traditionally, you start with a mechanism. And then after going through the mechanism, which is fairly lengthy for this lab, then she starts to analyze her product. And the analysis is proving that the product is what you say it is. Not so much proving its purity, but showing that the product is what we expect. In other words, our product is supposed to have a melting point of 162. If the melting point doesn't come up to 162, giving some reasons of why the melting point may be depressed and broad and off from 162. Checking the FTIR and going through and doing the infrared spectroscopy and talking about the peaks that are in the spectroscopy and whether they match or don't match the literature values for that compound. And there's some other things that we'll talk about. And then you wrap up in a conclusion and your references, you attach your spectrum and you attach your separation scheme. And beyond that, you would attach your lab notes. And I didn't include her lab notes on this one, but you would also include the lab notes if that were part of it. And notice that she included both the literature value of the reference spectrum and her spectrum that she obtained to be able to compare them so that we could see what's what. So there's a perfect model here to follow in terms of constructing yours. And I'll talk about some of the differences there. The rubric, while helpful, is not as helpful, I think, as much as the guidelines. The guidelines start off by telling you how I want you to format your document and what margins I want. Let me stop for a second. When you write a paper and you're going to submit it to a journal online and you're going to say, this is research that I have done and I'm going to write it up and I want other people to be able to read it. The first thing you do before you ever start writing is you go to the journal and you look at their instructions for authors. The instructions for authors tell you how to format your document, what margins you should have, how many columns it should be, the size of the figures, the size of the font, the type of font that should be used within the figures. The instructions for authors detail everything about what that submission should be. And if you don't follow the directions, they kick it back to you. They don't even review it. And they say, does not meet our specifications yet. And they ask you to then improve and fix all of the things that you missed within the instructions and then resubmit, and then they review it and go through and they do all of that. So these are my instructions to the author. And so we have some formatting things that are here, and then ways to construct your title, what your title should be and shouldn't be, what the abstract should include, what the introduction should focus on, what your methods and materials should look like, and examples of how they should be written. And then, as I said, the second paragraph here, where it starts off 15 milligrams of magnesium turnings, in parentheses 6.43 millimoles, were placed into a 20 mil round bottom flask. The flask was fitted with a magnetic stir bar, a Claisen head and rubber septa and drying tube. A solution of bromobenzene 1.01 grams, 6.43 millimoles in anhydrous diethyl ether, 4 milliliters was added to the stirred reaction flask via syringe dropwise. That is our Grignard reaction. That's exactly how it should be written out. And so this is a perfect model. And it may be very challenging to write something different than this. And I'm not asking you to write something different than this. You can pretty much copy and use this. but you need to change the numbers to reflect the numbers that were used in our experiment, because the numbers are not accurate. These were numbers that I had just made up as I was writing it, and they may not be exactly reflective of what was done in our particular experiment. So these instructions go all the way through, and then at the end of this procedure, the last thing says yield. I don't have a pointer, I'm sorry, but if you're looking, it is the third line from the bottom. It says yield 1.04 grams, 4.00 millimoles, 67%. That's actually damn close to what I got. That's pretty cool. And then melting point, 160.5 to 161. FTIR, solid KBR pellet, reciprocal centimeters. And then the X's are there as a placeholder for the values that you would put in that are the characteristic wavelengths that identify this compound out of the IR. Things that you could find that were large peaks in the IR that would be easy for somebody else to identify and say, yes, I have these peaks, therefore I have high confidence that my compound is that compound. We always put this in there, and it's redundant because you're going to have this in other places within your procedure, within your results section in your write-up. But formal reports are used in multiple ways. We have redundant information throughout formal reports all the time, because sometimes if I want to go into the lab and I just want to reproduce what you did, I don't want to have to dig through all your results section and everything to figure out what my yield should be or what my product should look like. I want it all in one concise place. And that's in your methods and materials section. At the end of where you tell somebody how to do it, you should also tell them what they are expected to get as an outcome from that. And so that's what that little piece is. So there's a perfectly good pattern here. The paragraph above it that details all of the other things, the bromobenzene, the magnesium turnings, the anhydrous diethyl ether, the 6-molar HCl, yes, all of those were for the Grignard. But then there's a break where I threw in extra equipment just to show you how equipment can be written up. So there is equipment in here, including an NMR and a mass spec and other things that we didn't use at all. But I just wanted to show you that data can be written up and an example of what it looks like if you were to have that type of data. Okay. Your results section, discussion, conclusion, and how it should be addressed. Language and formatting, the type of language constructs that we use. The difference between figures, charts, schemes, and tables, and how they should be formatted, and how the references should be formatted that you use. And then while I'm showing you the different types of references, I also show you how I would format them out if they were actually references. And these are the references that I used in putting together this document. So they're referenced out just to show you how that all goes together. And then the rubric I said was less helpful. Yes and no, it has each one of those components and how I grade, and it has breakdowns of mastery, accomplished, and adequate. What I would do if I were you is after writing my formal report, I would sit down with the rubric and I would try to use the rubric to score it. Or better yet, as a practice, take the rubric and score Nicole's paper using this rubric. Just go through and read her paper and sit down with the rubric and see what category her things fall into, which gives you a better idea of what it is that you're trying to do and looking for when writing your own paper as a suggestion. Okay. I'm sorry, I do have the chat up. Nobody's asking me anything. You guys are all just listening patiently. I see heads nodding once in a while. So I guess I'm doing okay. Not everybody's on screen, but that up.
Is there a good place or a place that has IR spectra for, like, you could look up just the IR spectra?
BB, yes, there is. One of my favorites. Google Japan spectroscopy database. I'm just going to click it because it's coming up. When you Google Japan Spectroscopy Database, this is one of my favorites because it's one of the largest and it's one of the most useful. Most of the chemical companies, Aldrich, Fisher, when you Google materials or you search their library of the materials that they sell, they generally have spectrum along with each of the materials they sell. So if we went to Aldrich and we searched triphenylmethanol at Aldrich, and then we were acting like we were going to buy it, and then we clicked on the link that said 250 mils of triphenylmethanol, 98.5%, in there in the link on that page, they would also have spectrum. And you could call up the spectrum and see what the spectrum looks like. But you got to dig for it. It's not easy to find all the time. So this is what I recommend instead. The site is called AIST, Spectro Database for Organic Compounds. And the AIST, I believe, is from the Japanese name. The site is in both English and in Japanese. It comes up default in English because of where we're Googling it from. And it's just a fantastic database. You have to agree to their disclaimer. And then you can search for spectrum in all different kinds of ways. And this is why it's so powerful, because I can take an unknown that I have an IR that is an unknown compound, I don't know what it is, and I can search on the IR peaks and it will pull up compounds that match those IR peaks, which means that I can look for unknowns in terms of both NMR or IR or mass spec, all kinds of things. I can search by CAS registry number, molecular weight, molecular formula. I can search by name or partial name, triphenyl methanol. It comes up with three hits, and I don't know why the methoxytriol alcohol comes. Oh, because it's methoxytriol alcohol. It's very similarly related to the triphenylmethanol. But click on the IR where it says Y. The Y is yes, the N is no, meaning yes, it has the spectrum, no, it doesn't have the spectrum. And then we want to make sure there's two different types of IR. So over on the left-hand side of the screen where I'm scrolling, there is IR KBR disc and IR Nugel mull. Nugel mulls are very common. A Nugel mull is where you take a long chain hydrocarbon oil and you grind your compound up in that oil, dispensing it, dissolving it in the oil. And then you take an IR of the drop of the oil. When you do that, the carbon hydrogen stretches are long. And so you can see on this IR, and I don't have a pointer. You can see on this IR that around the 3000, there's those really long peaks. Those are the carbon hydrogen stretches. That's what a Nugel, all Nugels have super long carbon hydrogen stretches because of the hydrocarbon that they're using as a dissolving agent. KBR, on the other hand, KBR does not have an absorbance in the IR, which is why I like to use it. And so this is the reference spectrum that we would be comparing ours against. And this is the reference spectrum for triphenylmethanol. So we'll pull these up and we'll look at it together too. And I'll come back to this. But yeah, Bibi, exactly. This is the site that I like to go to. And I always find it because I can never remember AIST or what it stands for, but I can always remember Japan Spectroscopy Database. And as soon as I see the ASIT, I know that's what I'm hitting, what I'm going for. Oops, wrong thing. Okay, so that's all of that information. Let's go back to our notes. Let's back it up for a minute. Let's talk about the introduction. The introduction is to stimulate interest. Talk about history or prior art. Why the work is important. How this work is different. And for us, this serves as the non-technical overview. Which is always sort of the last paragraph. For every lab that you do in school, you need to find why it's relevant. Why are we doing it? Triphenylmethanol is not important. Triphenylmethanol has no inherent value in industry that I'm aware of. I don't know of any place that it's used in industry as a material. As a molecule, it's completely uninteresting. And so our focus is not on the triphenylmethanol. It's on the Grignard reaction. Our focus should be on the ability to make new carbon-carbon bonds. And the fact that what a Grignard does is it takes an alkyl halide that is an electrophile and converts it into a Grignard that is a nucleophile, allowing to be able to make new carbon-carbon bonds. So what you want to do in the introduction is you want to cite this idea, this concept of being able to make carbon-carbon bonds for the purposes of making larger molecules. If we want to synthesize organic compounds, we need to be able to make carbon-carbon bonds. And what the Grignard reaction does is it works generally. This is a very general reaction. It works for alkanes. It works for alkenes. It works for alkynes. It works for aromatics. It works for just about everything under the sun, which is really cool. So that's why this reaction is important. And in this introduction, because the mechanism is so small, we can deal with it in the intro. So the mechanism is what is called oxidative insertion. It can be concerted or stepwise, depending on substrate. And we don't know which mechanism is operative, whether it's concerted or stepwise. So essentially all you really want to do is you really just want to take the idea of what your partial positive and partial minus is, how that magnesium has two valence electrons. And what it does, if we're thinking about it in terms of this way, is that the magnesium oxidatively inserts where that electron is given to the carbon and the other electron is given to the halogen, which makes my minus, my two plus, and my minus. And really, I think the better way to draw it, I mean, we draw the bond. Generally, we draw this, but what we're really meaning is we're really meaning this. The electron has been given to the carbon and is the reason that the carbon now has the negative charge. The magnesium's left holding the bag. It doesn't have any electrons or no valence electrons. They've been stripped. And the halogen has the extra electron, which is why it gets the negative charge. And so when we say concerted, it can step into this bond such that the bond breaking and bond making happen at the same time, or it can be a free radical reaction where one electron is given away, and then in a second step, the other electron is given away. Both mechanisms operate for Grignard's, and depending upon what the substrate is and the solvent is, it's either concerted or it's stepwise. And I can't tell you which mechanism is operative for this substrate because I just don't know. And I haven't done enough research or looking in the literature in order to figure it out. And it's not super important for us right now, because a mechanism is generally important when it gives you some information about regioselectivity or stereoselectivity. That's when we want to look at a mechanism. But when a reaction just goes and it goes no matter what, and it always gives the same thing and there's no selectivity to look at or investigate, then we don't really care about mechanism as much. It becomes not so important. And this is one of those reactions where it's just not so important. So that's why I say it can be dealt with within the introduction, and then you don't have to deal with it within the discussion. Or if you want to, you can hold it and you can deal with it just in the beginning of the discussion, just within a paragraph, and then you can move on to other things in the discussion. Entirely up to you, no right or wrong way there. So that's the introduction. The other thing that I want to talk about, because methods and materials, you kind of have under control now. The other thing that we should talk about is the discussion. If you look at Nicole's paper, she starts off with her mechanism. And that's generally the way most of these papers will deal with it. When there's a mechanism to discuss, like in the aspirin lab, they'll start with the mechanism. Then they move into product characterization. And they'll discuss each of their pieces of data that came out. They'll look at the percent yield and they'll have a paragraph. It's the symbol for a paragraph. They'll have a paragraph that is on their percent yield. They'll have a paragraph that is discussing the melting points. They'll have a paragraph that will discuss the FTIR. They may have a paragraph that discusses side products. For instance, the important part with the Grignard is that there are a couple of reactions that take place that lead to side products, water being one of the important ones. The water reaction is important not only to side products, but also to yield. Because if your yield is low, one of the reasons your yield could be low would be because of the presence of water and the fact that we did this reaction at the tail end of a giant storm and an atmospheric river that was pointed right at Monterey and Santa Cruz. And so having the humidity and the amount of moisture in the air as much as we did, it was tough to keep everything dry in order to get a good yield on this. I mean, I was hoping for a 75% yield, and I wound up with, and that would have been really good if I did that. And I wound up with something like a 67, which is not bad for this. The other reaction that's important to understand is where the biphenyl comes from. That is one of the possible side products. Biphenyl is made in a reaction called substitution nucleophilic aromatic. It's like SN2, but for aromatic molecules. And it goes through a complex that I believe is called a Meisenheimer complex. It has the negative charge attacking the position here, and the bromine doesn't get kicked out immediately. I apologize, this is splitting across pages. But what happens is we get a new bond to the carbon that also has the bromine in it, and a negative charge that resides, that is resonance stabilized. So this is the intermediate. And then that negative charge kicks back in, kicking out a leaving group, and the bromide is the better leaving group. And so what comes out of that is the biphenyl. And that's where that comes from. So if we step back for a second, let me step all the way back to where we began. Notice how much bromobenzene they used. They had it set up to use 6.69 millimoles of bromobenzene, but only 6.17 millimoles of magnesium, which means that they ran out of magnesium before they ran out of bromobenzene, which means that whatever excess bromobenzene was in there would turn around and react with the amount of Grignard that is there to make biphenyl. And then once all of that is exhausted, what's left reacts with the benzophenone. So that's where that material comes important. The percent yield, let's knock each one of these out in turn. Explain low yields. Water present, storm, oven off, and need to flame dry. Glassware assembled on camera. Slower than should be. Allowing water to get in, right? Because I was trying to film it at the same time. I wasn't focused on the chemistry. I was focused on the camera and trying to film it so you guys could see what I was doing. So all that makes a difference. So we want to explain loss in transfers. So these are what we call mechanical loss. That happens in places like the rotovap, where we need to scratch it out. Places like the trituration, where there's some loss to the solvent. Just different areas like that. So there's lots to talk about. What I'm trying to say is people say, oh, I got a 67% yield. Yield was okay. Move on. They got two sentences. I'm like, whoa, time out. There's a lot more that you could write about in terms of what affected that yield and why that yield may be what it is. All right, so I'm showing you how to build out the paragraphs. The melting point, what can we do with the melting point? The melting point, our melting point was low and broad. Much lower and broader than I expected. It was 155.4 to 157.5 or something. And it was expected lit is 161 or 162. So why was our melting point so low? Well, I recrystallized with isopropanol, 2-propanol, and dried only 5 minutes. There wasn't a whole lot of time between when I dried it and when I took the melting point, again, because I was fighting the time of the day and I just didn't have the time to allow it to sit and dry fully. And so the melting point was probably lower because there's probably a little bit of solvent still in it. What I would also do is point out no biphenyl. And no benzene. No starting material. So we're going to correlate several pieces of data here that the FTIR, when we look at it, we're not going to see biphenyl or benzene or benzophenone or bromobenzene. None of those things appear to be in the spectrum, which leaves solvent to be the only thing left that could really be contaminating that. So that builds out that. Let's take a look at the FTIR. Let me bring in our spectrum. Okay, so the morning lab said that you guys had covered IR in Zaruba's class. And so what I'll do is, you know, Zaruba talks about zones. There's a couple of zones that are important zones. So I'm going to cover those here. This is where we find hydroxyl groups. And depending upon the shape tells us what type of hydroxyl group. When it is a broad, smooth sort of peak, this is an alcohol. When it is got some jaggedness to it, and we see some of the carbon hydrogen stretches through, call this sort of a hairy beard thing. This is a carboxylic acid shape. And then there's some amines. There's ones that have a single peak that, and then there's ones that have two sharp peaks. And these are primary amines and secondary amines. So this is an NH2 and this one is an NH with two bonds off of it. And so depending on what comes in that range, it tells you what type of functional group you've got. And ours, here, the smoothness is matching the alcohol. So this is looking like an alcohol. in the range over here, this is the carbon hydrogen stretches. In the zone that is 1780, maybe even up as far as to 1800, on down to 1680, this is where carbonyls show up. And carbonyls are strong peaks. Carbonyls generally go down to like the 10% transmittance or less. And there is no carbonyl in here, which means that benzophenone is not showing up in my spectrum. So there's no benzophenone, which is a good thing. That's what I want. I don't want to see any benzophenone. So we have to remember what our structure is. So when I highlight these out, there's a couple of different ways that I do it. Sometimes I'll use color to make it easier. That's my hydroxyl group that I'm looking at there. And then the carbon hydrogen stretches, all molecules have carbon hydrogen. And so these aren't quite that important. And then everything that's in here, there's nothing in here that's really very helpful at all. Most of this is just what we call fingerprint region. But what is important to do is to see if this matches with the literature values or not. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull this in one more time. And on top of it, I'm going to layer over this guy. And I can't overlap them entirely, but what I can do, and I really want to sort of walk through both of these with you, is I want to show you how we compare IRs. What's important to compare and what's not. What we want to do is we want to look at the pattern. Not absolute percent T or even wave number. The pattern is more important than the absolute percent or even the wave number. And it's the relative pattern that is really critical. And everything must match. So when I say everything must match, what I mean is, when we look at the alcohol, it has the same general shape. It's fairly sharp, comes to a nice point. It's smooth. There's nothing else in there. When I go to this peak here, that is the carbon hydrogen stretches, look how much it matches. See the shoulder that's right here? So I come down to a shoulder, and then I go long, and then I come back to short. And even that short has a little sort of diagonalness to it, meaning that there's actually two peaks that are in there before it goes back up. Now, I won't be able to see that little two peaks on this one, but I can definitely see that shoulder, the shoulder that is off to the left. And then I come down to a long and shorter peak. Shoulder, long, short. As I come over here, I can even see some of this pattern reflected, even though it's very close to the baseline. This guy here starts us off, and it's sitting right there. And then there's a mound and a mound. And I've got those two mounds. They're not real clear in the bottom spectrum, but I can see the tapering off of this mound and the tapering off that I expect there. Now, this is one area that I highlight that sort of I see as an issue, and I don't know what it means. Oops, that is not what I wanted. What I mean by I don't know what it means is it's not reflected up here. See how sharp this is and has no shoulder to it? This has a strong shoulder to it. The fact that we don't have that shoulder implies to me that this material, this reference spectrum, given how closely everything else matches, that that might be a little bit of solvent that is in their reference spectrum that is not in ours. But that's the only thing that doesn't really match super well. And as we go through, you'll see, let me zoom out so that we can see the whole thing. Okay, we come down, sharp peak, and then that little shoulder on the right. Sharp peak, the little shoulder on the right. And then we have sort of a medium and then a fairly long peak. Medium, fairly long, both very sharp. The wave numbers will match pretty closely too. Now I've got this little shoulder that's right there and the little shoulder that's right there. It comes down, back up to a shoulder, back up to a higher shoulder before it hits baseline. Comes down, back up to a shoulder, back up to a shoulder before it hits baseline. Comes down and I have some jaggedness in here, a small peak and then a long peak. There's my jaggedness, my small peak and my longer peak. Come back up and I hit that little peak that's right in between. It's right there. Now notice I'm not talking wave number through any of this. All I'm doing is pattern matching. And that's what's more important than wave number matching, because from instrument to instrument, the wave numbers change slightly, but the pattern is what's more important. So then I come down and I think we're in this guy here now. So I got the shoulder that's on that side that actually comes down to about there, and the line makes it hard to read. And then I've got this piece and it has a little shoulder on it right there. That's this guy with his little shoulder right there. And then I come up 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. All the way over. 1, 2, 3. Short, long, short. Short, long, short. That needs to be repeated. That little guy is right there. And even that little one that's in there, I think is in here. And then this last part has a little more definition. This is kind of smoothed out, but it's a perfect match all the way through. You don't do that in the formal report, but what you're looking to see is if it doesn't match, you're looking to see where it doesn't match. And then that's what you highlight in the formal report. So far in here, everything with the exception of that little tiny shoulder right there doesn't match, but it's a perfect match otherwise. So it is triphenylmethanol and it's a good literature match. And for peaks that I would cite, remember when I was talking about, it's not in here, it's not in there. Remember when I was talking about this? Formal report guidelines. The X's that are in here that are the wavelengths that you report for the FTIR, the wavelengths that I would want to pick in going through and looking at my spectrum to pick wavelengths is I would pick wavelengths that are representative, that are easily distinguishable. I would pick that wavelength. I would pick the long wavelengths that are over here that are easy to read. Maybe that guy, maybe this guy, because it's sitting all by itself. And that's enough. We don't have to pick everything. We pick like 4 or 5 that are really easy to find and distinctive, that would jump out of you from a spectrum that are sort of like the biggest peaks. Or if there are ones that define functional groups, such as a carbonyl or hydroxyl or things that match the functional groups within our compound, we want to make sure that we pick those. in absence of those, we just kind of pick the biggest ones and we list the biggest ones. All right. Gee, that's a lot of information I've given you. That goes through our percent yield. That goes through our melting points. That goes through our FTIR. And I think I've covered just about everything. How are you guys doing? Is this helpful? Overwhelming? Slightly overwhelming? It's a lot of information. My concern is this, I'll tell you this. Last semester, I didn't do any formal reports with my students, and I let Chem1B get away with not doing a formal report. Not only that, I didn't film any labs, and trying to teach them over the web was challenging. And I came away feeling like I did a disservice to my students last semester. And so I'm trying to change that, and I'm trying to give you guys a better lab experience, more consistent with what we would normally do, at least trying to show you what the lab looks like and what the experiments look like. And if I can help you with your writing, this is one of the most critical things that I can help you with, is being able to write formal reports. Because as you go on, your instructors, as you go on from here, are going to know that you haven't had a lab experience. And so they're going to treat you carefully in the lab and try to help you in the lab to gain those lab experiences, but they're going to expect that you did writing, and they're not going to be very forgiving for you in terms of your understanding of how to write about chemistry or how to write formal reports. And so this is probably the best thing that I could do for you and skill set that I can give you, is to help you to develop this skill set. So thanks, I like the comments. And I have a new toy. Let's just have to show off for a second. Come on, little microphone. Stop the screen share. Okay, so all of my videotaping that I was doing, I was doing okay because I've been using this gimbal. And the gimbal gives me a lot of filming flexibility, which is pretty cool. And it goes on and off a tripod and stuff. But I had this microphone, which is what they call a shotgun mic. And the shotgun mic is directional, and it really only picks up audio of what you're pointing at, which is why sometimes when I set things down on the table, the glassware is such a sharp and loud noise, and my voice can be really quiet, because this is pointing off to the side a little bit while I'm talking, and I'm trying to look at all the glassware, and I want the camera focused at what I'm doing, and that hasn't been working so well. So I got these. One's a receiver and the other one's a lapel microphone. So the microphone is going to be on me, not on the camera. And so no matter where I go, hopefully the sound quality is going to be much better in the next videos that we do. Plus I won't get tangled up with cords and everything. So this is, I'm hoping, I have big hopes for this. We'll see how this works. Basically, this is an excuse for me to buy a bunch of toys. That's what I'm looking at here. I need excuses to buy toys apparently, and this gave it to me. All right, questions. What can I do here? What can I help you with beyond what I've already done? And let's also be cognizant that questions may not all arise right now when you're introduced to this material. So my plan is in the next lab period, I think I'm going to use for a problem solving session. We can dedicate some of it to questions about the formal reports and the labs, if you have questions after trying to go through the material and trying to write up some of it. But the rest of it I want to use for like lecture and doing some problem solving skill sets. And then as we get into the next lab session after that, I think we'll use it as a check-in before the formal reports are due to try to get any last minute questions and solve any last minute questions. And I think I had one more thing. It slipped my mind, it was gone, it was important. Come back. Questions, problem solving. Formal reports, calculations. It's not coming back. Let me look at my notes that I did this morning and see if I see it there. What did I do? Shoot, it jumped into my brain and then it jumped out. It was something to do with the chemical reaction and writing the form. Oh, that's it. Cool. Okay, let's look at Nicole's paper for a second. See these structures that Nicole has? No, you can't, because I'm not screen sharing, so you have no idea what I'm showing you. Okay, now you can see Nicole's paper. See the structures and even the color that Nicole put into these structures? Structures like this are really hard to draw. What a lot of students do is they feel pressured to give nice structures because they think that that's going to impact their grade. And they go online to try to find the structures that they want and copy and paste them from online. Don't do that. Don't try to draw them with a drawing program like Nicole did here. This is really hard to do and really expensive to buy the software to do it. So what I would do is in your writing, let's say that you're writing a paragraph. And as you're writing the paragraph, you're going to want to insert an image in here. And you want the image to be the formation of the Grignard reagent. What I would say is leave space and come back in and just hand draw this in. You can even draw it in pencil if you want. It really doesn't matter to me. And then it has a caption, Formation Grignard. And then you've got the rest of the paragraph that keeps going. Leave space, draw by hand. It's going to take so much time to learn how to use the drawing software. It's frustrating. It slows you down. You could spend hours trying to do the structures. I'd rather you spend hours doing the writing. Not doing the structures. Just draw the structures by hand. Make it easy on yourself. Okay. The software that does this, ChemDraw, is the golden standard of software. For an educational license, it's over $500 for an educational license for that. ChemDoodle, which works good on the Mac. Educational used to be about $20. I think that this is now running somewhere in the $40 to $60 range. So even the lowest end of the software that can do these types of drawings is still really expensive. And I don't want you to have to spend that money. So just draw it by hand. Save time, focus on other things. You have other classes besides mine. I don't want you to spend all your time on my class. Plus, we have other things that we need to do in lecture. And that's really, really important there too. So I want you to use your time wisely, okay? That's why that was so important. I didn't want to lose that. When it popped into my mind, I was like, this is really important to say and we need to get this on here. So there you go. All right, I've been talking forever. We need to get out of these chairs and we need to move around. So I will answer questions but I'm going to stop the video recording and call it a day. Okay. And anybody is free to go who wants to, and I'll catch you guys later, but I'll stick around and answer any questions that you have.